We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
What can you tell me that your person beside you is noticing that is odd? What are the strange things about the chapters? Let's see if we can gather them up quickly as a whole group. What did you notice that was odd? The healing didn't work the first time around. That's odd, yeah?
He just performed an amazing miraculous sign. They say performed for a sign,
so
they're not going to give you a sign.
Yeah, I mean, why are they asking for a sign? He's just fed 4,000. And why does he say he's not going to give one when he just fed 4,000? Yeah, that's pretty odd. Yeah. Yeah, what's all the number of loaves and who's keeping count? You know, we're dealing with 4,000, 5,000 people. What's that about, yeah? That's it? You were all saying exactly those same things? No, what else?
Peter just declares him the Christ and then he goes on about the Son of Man or something.
Yeah, why does he change from the Christ to the Son of Man? Yeah? Yeah, it's pretty odd, isn't it, to see blind men walking around as men walking around as trees. Yeah, it's yep. Trees walking, you're pretty odd. Yep. Yeah, all those people couldn't remember the food. They're daft. Yeah. Calls Peter Satan. Yeah, that's pretty odd, isn't it? Yeah. He talks about taking up his cross, which is a phrase that if you're around Christian circles you hear often, but when you actually read it and think about it, what's it mean, carrying a cross? Yeah. All right, there are some odd things, yeah. Yeah, again, he's telling people not to tell who he is. All right, let's look in it. One of the odd things that's there that we need to try and work out all the time with Mark's gospel is, how does it fit together? We've got this story, we've got that story, we've got that story. What's he done? Is he kind of just throwing them up where they've landed? He's put them in that order. Why is this story recorded here? In fact, Jesus did many, many miracles. He healed lots and lots of people. Why does he choose these ones to tell us about? What is there special about these particular ones, and why are they organised in the pattern they're organised in? Let me show you first of all the linkages, because I think the chapter really does flow along a certain theme. That is, there are two kinds of subjects that are there, and they are linked. The first is the subject of bread. He's in chapter 8, the beginning there, he feeds the multitude. And then he says to the disciples in verse 15, beware of the yeast, the bread, of the Pharisees. They don't understand it. And so he says to them, they think that he's worried about the fact that they haven't got any bread with them, which is pretty daft if you think about it. Now, there's only 12 of them and they've already got one loaf and he's pretty good at feeding multitudes. They think that. And so he goes on to talk to them about the bread. Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not understand? Are your hearts hardened? And then the subject changes to the second subject of the chapter. Do you have eyes but fail to see, ears and fail to hear? Don't you remember? And then he reminds them of the bread, but he goes on to talk about blindness. And just as he's been talking about blindness, lo and behold, he is a blind man. But this blind man's healing is not like most of the healings. And so verse 22 following, you get this blind man who couldn't see, but then sees dimly, and then sees clearly. So verse 18 is the link between the bread subjects that he's dealing with, moving on to the blindness subjects that he's dealing with. And the blind man introduces the great climax of the first half of the book of Mark. This is the turning point of the book, which is why we're finishing our Mark series this week and picking up 9 to 16 next session. Because here is the great turning point. From chapter 1, verse 1, you and I, the readers, have been told that Jesus is the Christ. But no one in the events has seen that Jesus is the Christ except the evil spirits, whom he constantly silences and tells not to tell anybody about it. But no one has seen it. And then now, at last, the disciples see it. You are the Christ. At last, they've cottoned on. But now they've cottoned on, they still don't understand. At last they can see, but yet they can't see. Let's pick up the theme of blindness. You see, the Pharisees are blind men. They come to test Jesus in verse 11. They begin to question Jesus to test him. They ask him for a sign from heaven. Now, you can test people for lots of reasons. You can test them so as to find out what they know. Or you can test them so as to qualify them to proceed on to the next year at university. Or you can test them so as to disqualify them from proceeding on to the university. You can actually set up tests to exclude people as much as you can set up tests to include people. Why, there are some educationists that set up testing in order to give people a happy educational experience. There's all kinds of reasons for testing. I've never met many students who have agreed with that theory of testing, but there are those who inflict it on others who agree wholeheartedly. Why do the Pharisees test Jesus? Is it to find out the truth, or is it to find fault with him? That's the latter. They're not trying to pass the candidate, they're trying to fail the candidate. And their testing is a testing of blindness, the blindness of those who will not see. There is none so blind as those who will not see. They are blinder than people who cannot see. Someone who cannot see may have his blindness corrected, but a person who will not see can never have their blindness corrected. It is a choice that they have made. You see, Jesus just fed 4,000 people. Again, the supernatural feeding of by bread in the wilderness. These people are supposed to be looking for a new Moses. Moses who fed the multitude bread out in the wilderness. Jesus is just doing the very thing that you would expect a Moses to do. But do they see Moses? No. In fact, they don't even see the miraculous side of it. They say, well, that was a pretty good one. Have you got another one? I just want to see could you do a couple more? I mean, I hear you walked on the water. Would you mind have a quick shot across the bay now so we can see you again? The Pharisees may not have been where Jesus was when he did this miracle. You see how it talks about Jesus crossing the lake in verse 10. That is, the last time we saw Jesus, he was in the area called the Decapolis over here on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. And Dalmanutha, it's mentioned in verse 10, is also known by the name Magdala. And so he's crossed back over into the Jewish area. Galilee was Jewish. Bashan was basically a Gentile area, though there were Jews that lived out there. Maybe the Pharisees didn't see it because he's crossed across the sea. He's now going to speak to his disciples up in Caesarea Philippi, well away from the Jewish area of the town of the country. And he's moving around all the time, and he's staying generally on the edges of the Jewish community rather than in the heartland. The heartland, of course, is down here in the green area, in particular at the city of Jerusalem. He's up in Judea, which is Jewish, but 50% Jewish. But he keeps nicking over into Bashan, which is less than 50%, only 10% or something like that Jewish. And it's there that many of the miracles are happening. But the miracles are happening amongst Jewish people who go out after him into the wilderness. The Pharisees no doubt have heard about it. I mean, you can't feed 4,000 or 5,000 people without somebody mentioning it. I mean, that's not the kind of activity that could be kept quiet. They want to see signs for themselves. Why? Well, they want to see the fault. They want to find him at fault. Give us a sign. Jesus does not do signs so as to show off. Jesus does not do signs so as to win disciples. Jesus does not do miracles to overpower people with the awestruck, gobstruck kind of this must be God. That is not what Jesus is about. Jesus responds to the situation he's in as God would respond to the situation he's in. As God fed the multitude of his people in the wilderness, so does God's Son feed the multitude in the wilderness. He responds to the need of the situation as God would respond to the need of the situation. But the way in which he responds is the same way God responds, so that if you've got eyes to see, if you've got your Old Testament glasses on, you say, boy, it's just like Moses. And then you remember that Moses said, someone is going to come to who's just like me. And he's a bloke who's just like him, doing the very same kinds of things, walking across the water, keeping his people safe, feeding the multitude in the wilderness. This is just like Moses, but they are fixated on having signs, having miracles. Do some more party tricks for us, Jesus. And so Jesus warns the disciples of this blindness, a blindness that seeks proof, but actually doesn't want it. It wants signs and miracles, but it doesn't want to see what they signify and will not look at the evidence that is before them. However, it's a hypocritical blindness because it keeps pretending to look. It keeps asking for evidence. But it's not asking for evidence in order to find out. It's asking for evidence in order to disprove. You often see it today. You see it in Muslim literature and you see it in Jehovah's Witnesses when you talk to them. They only actually discuss the Bible in order to demonstrate that you're wrong. They don't really listen to the argument. They've already, while you are talking, working out what's wrong with your argument to show you that you're in fault. But you don't have to look at the Muslims and the Jehovah's Witnesses for it. Just find the average Christian like you or me. Don't we do the same thing? Are we listening in order to find out what the other person actually believes? Or are we listening to find out what's wrong with what the other person believes? Haven't you done that? Haven't you fallen into the same kind of blindness? Oh, you're polite, you wait till they finish. And you play the game, you ask questions because you are in a discussion. But you're actually not, are you? It's kind of an interrupted monologue. And you can be in a room where you've got two people both having an interrupted monologue. They keep interrupting each other's monologue. And nobody is actually listening to anybody. But they go out feeling satisfied that they have put across their point of view. You often see it because people are not open. And they're not open often to the truth of God and his word. Most commonly, you see the insistence on God justifying himself to the unbeliever. For there are many of us who do not believe in God and Jesus, and who will come even to campus Bible study and will ask questions. But they're not actually asking and they're not coming to find the truth. They're asking and coming in order to show that it's wrong. Now, in one sense, it's a correct procedure, isn't it? The scientific methodology is that you've got to disprove things rather than confirm things. But they're not even using a scientific methodology of setting up a hypothesis and putting up the null hypothesis and disproving the null hypothesis so as to... They're not even doing that. They're just trying to ask questions, because you've got to be open-minded, in order to show that they really are closed-minded. Well, no, not to show it, but that's where it comes from, because it doesn't matter what evidence is shown to them, they will not believe. And it's a game, an intellectual game. My friends, you can't in the end judge God. See, the unbeliever wants God to satisfy the unbeliever that he is there, he is powerful, he's going to judge the world. But God is not answerable to an unbeliever. God is not answerable to a believer. God is not answerable to his own creatures. We've got it the wrong way around. We are answerable to God, but God is not answerable to us. You see, unbelievers have dispensed with God and established themselves as God in the world, in their own little world. And as God, then everything is answerable to me. The ants that crawl into my picnic lunch, they're answerable to me. Right? The pieces of paper that fall out of my bag, they're answerable to me. Everything is answerable to me. My parents, my neighbours, you are answerable to me because I am God in my world. And if I don't like you, I just leave you out of my world. And if you're willing to serve me, I'll include you in my world. And if you fail me, I don't like you anymore and I leave you out of my world. Everything is answerable to me. Now, if that is your philosophy of life, then you hear about another person called God, spelt with a capital G this time, and you say, well, now, does he fit in my world? He's got to be answerable to me too. I mean, I'll believe in him provided he does these things for me. And if he does these things, I'll believe in him. And if he doesn't do them for me, then, well, he can take a running jump as well. But God is not answerable to me. I am answerable to God. It matters little on the last day what I think of God. It answers a lot. It means a lot on the last day what God thinks of me. I'm not used to dealing with something bigger and greater than myself. Except my wife, of course. But I'm not used to dealing with something that's greater than myself. Everything is lesser than me. The animals, the cockroaches, the paper, the computer, anything and everything is less than me. And so I'm not used to the category of thought of what you do when you come into contact with something that is greater, let alone infinitely greater than me. And so I look like I'm judging when even the activity is fairly sus, dealing with God. Here they are face to face with a man who's just fed 9,000 people in two accounts, who walks across water, who exorcises at a word, who heals people of various diseases, who's raised the dead. Here is somebody, and what are they saying? Well, come on, walk across my swimming pool. I mean, let's really see what kind of party trick you can pull. It looks like they're inquiring. It's not. So Jesus warns the disciples of their blindness. He says, you be careful of this blindness, this hypocritical closeness of the mind and heart. I mean, the disciples, they're blind too. Oh, they're open-minded, not like the disciples. They've left all to follow Jesus, but they're still blind because they keep getting everything wrong all the time, don't they? Even when Peter identifies Jesus as the Christ, he still retains a blindness because Jesus says, yes, I am, and I'm going off to be crucified. And Peter says, hang on, you're not going to do that. Which itself is self-contradictory. You are the king. I am your servant. Now let me tell you, king, what you've got to do. Is actually to misunderstand the idea of what a king is, isn't it? I mean, it's self-contradictory that Peter, the servant of the king, is telling the king how he's got to serve. It's not right. Peter continues, but the Bible is full of the beauty of this blindness of the disciples. I love the fact that the disciples are so stupid. For a couple of reasons. One, it enables me to identify with them. That may not be a problem for you, but for me, it's really nice to see that the original Christians were people who opened their mouths to change feet regularly. It makes me feel acceptable within the club, and that's very helpful. In chapter 9, you can steal next session's thunder, there's a wonderful one where Peter speaks up and says something to Jesus. Verse 5, let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. Lovely verse 6, one of my favourite verses. He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. That's brilliant, isn't it? At the very moment you don't know what to say, what do? Say something. That's what you do. I mean, whatever else you've got to do when you don't know what to say, open your mouth and let it fly. That's it. So, I can relate to a man like that. I'm a well-known vacuum filler. In fact, in many a wedding in years gone by, my wife and I were put on the table of the people that were leftovers. You know, the people that no one knew. They had to have them at the wedding, but they didn't know what to do with them. So we used to get put on the table of the leftovers because they knew we could fill the vacuum. And we could keep talking, even though there was nothing to talk to these strange people about. Never seemed to slow us down any. So I can identify with a man like this who opens his mouth and gets it all wrong. But I also like it because it shows that we're dealing with the real historical documents. You see, especially amongst religious-y kinds of groups, especially in groups over time, the founding fathers of any movement get written as more and more acceptable creatures, don't they? And their warts get left off, and their corns and barnacles, and you just get holier and holier kinds of men. The apostles are the great holy men. And indeed, later Christian literature, that's how they come out too. But in gospel literature, they come out as blithering idiots. And you wouldn't write them up like that in the 3rd century, or the 4th century, or the 5th century. You wouldn't write them up down the track like that. You'd only write them like this if you were one of them and remembered how stupid you were. It's got to do with coming right back to the original documents, that you don't have it glossed over. So I like it. Jesus fed 5,000 in chapter 6. He feeds 4,000 in chapter 8. And there's leftover on each occasion. Lots of leftover. Now here are 12 of them sitting in a boat with a loaf of bread. And they're saying, I think he's talking about the fact we haven't bought enough bread again. I mean, you've got to give it to them. They're pretty consistent. They never bring enough bread. That is one point of consistency. But, you know, they're in the hands of a man who can feed multitudes. Thousands out of each bread, each loaf. And there's only a dozen of them. And they still can't work it out that it's got nothing to do with bread. It's got nothing to do with miraculous power. It's got to do with blindness. Jesus has just illustrated that the new Exodus is on, that he's the new Moses. But they still forget that man will not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. That's what Moses taught. It's not about bread. They're blind. But there is another man who is blind in verse 22 following. He's really blind physically. Literally blind. And this is an unusual healing, not because it's private. Jesus healed other people privately, the little girl or the deaf mute back in chapter 7, verse 33. Not because he uses spittle, that's slightly unusual, but he does that back in chapter 7 as well. Now what is unusual is that it's a two-stage healing. All the other healings, Jesus just speaks, or he just touches, or he just... and the person's immediately, completely, miraculously healed. Not this bloke. Jesus heals him, and yet he's not healed. Now what's that saying? Is his blindness so profound that Jesus can't do it with one hit? No, there's in chapter 9 of John's Gospel a man who's born blind that Jesus heals in one hit. What's so difficult about this man? Is he saying, well, if a person's born blind, they won't see immediately straight away? Yeah, well, that's true. I've read a book by Oliver Sacks recently, which talks about, he's a neurologist, American neurologist, and a very interesting writer. He writes very, very poorly, but then again, he's a doctor. But it's a very interesting book, nonetheless, about the difficulty of a man who was made blind by a disease when he was about 2 years old, and then when he's 40, 50 years old, having lived in poverty and no one noticing it, he married a Christian woman who actually saw that his blindness was a disease and could be cured, and he was cured, and he was restored sight. But he'd never learned how to see, and he couldn't see. I mean, the whole world was just impossible for him to cope with. See, he knew his dog by its feel. He knew his cat by its feel. But when he looked at them, he didn't know which was which. He would have to close his eyes and feel them to know which was which. And he looked at his dog, looking at him, and he knew his... well, he didn't know. So he felt it. No, that's my dog, looking at me. He opened his eyes, knew what it was. The dog turned around. He thought, what's that thing? Because he'd never seen a dog from the back before. He'd only seen a dog from the front, and then only a few seconds ago. And then he couldn't remember what he had seen because there were so many things around him that he was seeing that he couldn't. After a year or two, he went psychologically blind, psychiatrically blind, and he never restored his sight again. His eyes worked, his brain could not take in the information. And so it's a neurological problem which Oliver Sacks could describe but could not cure, and found that the few occasions down in history when totally blind people had received their sight, that indeed was the problem, and several of them suicided, several of them just closed down mentally, and hardly any of them could regain psychiatrically, neurologically,
mentally, the capacity to see, even though the eyes were now functioning. So here, this is what we've got. I mean, this has got a reality. In fact, Oliver Sacks refers to this very passage as an indication, yes, you get your sight, but the men, they look like trees walking. I don't know what I'm seeing. I can't understand why. I know it's a man because he's talking to me. But he looks like what I thought a tree would look like. I mean, that's a real description of the kind of thing. Is that all it is? No, I don't think it is. Because on John chapter 9, it's not like that. No, no, it's being recorded for us because this is what is happening. Here is the great climax, the blindness that is coming to sight at last, but it's coming in a couple of stages. The two stages of the opening of the eyes of the disciples in particular. He sees the trees walking around. It's a kind of funny perception. You see, the crowds were blind. The crowds didn't know who Jesus was, but they followed him out into the wilderness. They had a sight, but it wasn't a proper sight. They spent 3 days out in the wilderness with him. Even when they'd run out of food, they were still there. They didn't go home. They saw that in Jesus there was a great one. But they didn't know who he was. Look at verse 27, 28. Who do the crowd say that I'm? Who do the people say that I'm? Well, some say you're John the Baptist. Others say you're Elijah. Still others say you're one of the prophets. He wasn't any of those three things. I mean, those three things would be enough possibly to get you out in the wilderness to listen to a bloke, but that's not who he was. He was somebody else other than that. You see, they saw, but they didn't see properly. They were still blind. And the disciples, well, they finally get it right. And the disciples who had fed the multitudes with Jesus, Jesus says, you, what about you, verse 29, who do you say that I am? And they say, ah, you are the Messiah, you are the Christ. At last they've got it. 7.5 chapters it's taken them. A couple of years in lifetime it took them. But they finally, the pennies have dropped. You are the Christ, the Messiah. Jesus said, yes, don't tell anybody. And the Son of Man, and he doesn't go and talk about himself as the Messiah. He keeps talking himself about now the Son of Man. That's a funny twist. Why? Well, because they got the right label, but they got the wrong product. That's the problem. They got the right label, wrong product. Yes, he's the Messiah, but not the kind of Messiah they're thinking of. And so he uses this other term, Son of Man, and teaches them what the Son of Man is, and it's not until chapter 14, to steal the thunder, that he puts Son of Man and Christ back together again. And then you realise he's a Son of Man kind of Christ. It's that kind of Christ we're talking about. And so he begins to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer, die, and in 3 days rise again. And you can see the reaction of Peter. No, 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 you're the Christ. The Christ doesn't die. The Christ does die. Not your kind of Christ, Peter, but your kind of Christ is the wrong kind of Christ. Went to South Africa last week and so, went and was shown this store called Woolworths. Went inside, and Woolworths in South Africa is different to Woolworths in Australia. Different kind of department store. Right label, wrong product. Now, I'm going to America next couple of weeks to sell Two Ways to Live in a big clergy conference and our interactive Bible study. So campus Bible study moves on to Exodus, and other people will be here teaching you the Bible. Over in America, there's a big problem I have because, you know, all know I love eating, don't you? Well, in America, they call entrees the main course. So I went to a restaurant and I said, oh, skip the entree, let's get on with the main course. Well, the main course after the entree is the desserts. That's not really what I call a decent meal. There's rarely any meat in a dessert. They got the right name, the right label, got the wrong product. They got the right name, Christ, got the wrong product. For them, Christ, conquering, ruling king. Well, he is going to be that, yes. You know, that's true. An entree in Australia is food, but if you're an American and you think you're going to fill yourself up on an entree, you've got a very small diet. It's a fairly anorexic way of eating. Got the right product? No. He's going to come to suffer and die and be killed and rise on the third day. Whoa, that's not what I was thinking. But that's what he needs. So they see like the blind man. They've got half sight now. The second half of the gospel, they're going to receive the full sight. So Mark puts this blind man in at this point in the account
Not just because it happened then, just because it happened this way, because it actually explains to the reader what in fact is happening to the disciples and the crowds. And of course the Pharisees, who don't even get to see at all because they come to test. But in Jesus opening their eyes like this and beginning to teach the disciples, as they start to see everything clearly by the end of the gospel, you can start to understand who he is, why he came, and what he expects. For the three things are linked together. He is the Christ. We've got that one now. He comes to die for the sins of the world and rise again. And if he is the Christ who came to do that, then what he requires of us is to deny ourselves, take up the cross, and follow him. He is the Christ. Who he is, because he is the King, he can set out why he's doing, what he's doing, why he's doing it, and what we've got to do. If he is the Christ, then he can tell us what to do because he's the King. But why he has come is to suffer. Because the conquest he's interested in is not the militaristic conquest of Rome, but the spiritual conquest of Satan. He's not come to liberate Jerusalem from imperial Rome, he's come to liberate humanity from imperial Satan. From our sin, from death that follows from it. That's the battle he's come to do. And that's why he came to die, to ransom us as captives out of sin, to conquer sin, Satan, death. That's why he is dying and rising again. He is the Saviour. And that's why he calls upon everybody. Verse 34, then he called the crowd, not just the disciples, the crowd, to him, along with the disciples. And he said, if anyone, that's us, that's you, that's me, that's anyone, if anyone would come after me, well, he's got to deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. That's what he expects as the King. You've got to deny yourself. I mean, the word deny is to say no. If you deny an accusation against yourself, you say, no, I didn't do it. If you deny yourself an ice cream, you're sick. Always say yes, and anyone offers you one, right? But you say no to the ice cream. That's what denying means, doesn't it? What does he ask you to deny in verse 34? Well, there, he says you've got to deny yourself. And you want to say, well, deny yourself what? No, no, just deny self. You've got to say no to self. That's what it is. It's not, I'm going to knock off eating hamburgers, or I'm going to knock off eating Big Macs, or I'm not going to knock off eating... No, I'm going to deny myself, my own self-government, my own self-rule, my own self-determination. I've got to deny myself. Why? Because he's king, not me. If I'm saying you're the king, then I'm no longer the king. He's the king. I've got to deny myself. But if I'm going to be in his kingdom, I've got to go his way, that is to take up the cross. In Romans, they crucified people fairly regularly in Palestine in the first century. And once a person was condemned to death, they were responsible to carrying their cross piece, the bar, not actually the cross, but the bar, out to the place of execution. And it was like the medieval stocks, where people put their arms and hands through kind of holes in a plank, and then the crowd could come around and jeer and make fun of them. Once you were carrying the cross piece, you were a condemned villain, and the crowd could make as much sport with you as they wanted to. It was said that several men were desperate to get to the place of execution because the crowd had treated them so badly on the way. That's the image that Jesus is picking up. It was a common first century enough image. You're going to be my disciples. Well, I am the king who comes to be crucified, and you come with me. You be willing to deny yourself and give up this world and accept the hatred and the despising of this world. Come follow me. You say, well, that sounds like I've got to give up everything. And the answer is verse 35. If you want to be my disciples, drop dead. It's basically what he's saying. For if you want to be my disciples, you've got to lose your life for me and for the gospel. You say, well, why would I want to lose my life? And the answer is to gain it. For if, verse 35, if you gain your life now, say, no, I'm not going to give up my life, I'm going to hang on to my life now, well, where is it going to end? In the grave. In the crematorium flue. That's where it's going to end, isn't it? Whereas if you give your life to Jesus now, then he comes to save your life. And where will it end? But in eternity with him. Lose your life now, save it then. Save your life now, lose it then. But notice the character of what it is to follow Jesus. It is to lose your life. You've got to give your life to him. It's nothing less. But then again, he, the king, has come to give his life for you. And so what he is asking you to do is totally appropriate to who he is and why he has come. And you say, well, that's a big ask. It is a big ask, but look at the alternative in verse 36. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world if he's going to forfeit his life? What have you got at the end of your life if you've got everything that's going? Well, you've got a bigger crematorium plaque with lots of initials written after your name. You've got a bigger cemetery plot. You've got one of those mausoleum ones where people can walk in and look at your coffin. You've got a better kind of coffin. Or you can go the Princess Di way and have your own little island that they can put your coffin in and people can row their boat out to have a look at where you are. Take their dogs out to lift their leg on it. What have you got if you've gained everything and lost your life? You've got nothing. And you know you are going to lose your life, don't you? That's a certain. So if you know you're going to lose your life, and if you know you've gained everything in this world, you've gained your rock, you've gained your overseas trip, you've gained your degree, you've gained the boy of your dream, the girl of your dreams, you've got the two dogs, the ticky-tacky three-bedroom suburban house, you've got the two dogs, the two cars, you've got the private school education for your children, if you've got all this, you've got nothing if you haven't got your soul. That's the emptiness of materialism, isn't it? Jesus said, you're ashamed of me in this world, I'll be ashamed of you in the next, verse 38. You're going to face the next. You better face it with a soul intact. It can only be intact by the one who purchased it for you. They started to see. Do you start to see? Once you see who he is, you can start seeing why he came. Once you see who he is and why he came, you can start to see what you've got to do. Deny yourself. Take up your cross. Follow him. Do you see? Just get this little slip out for a moment. Should have told you to fill in the name on the way through. Take a moment if you're filling out the name, because I want to draw your attention to two little boxes at the bottom of it in particular. You'll see there one that says, I anticipate that I'll be graduating this year. Anticipate. It's a lovely word, isn't it? Anticipate. If that is the case, please tick that, because we've got a special program for people graduating next year, at the end of this year. We've got a special program through second session and we want to be in touch with you. But either way, filling it in is helpful to us to know you're still with us and to chase up the people who have given up on campus Bible study. But notice down the bottom there's a box there which says Investigating Christianity. I'd like more information on it. You see, there are some people who are beginning to see, but it's still confused. They still can't quite work it out what it is. We'd like to help you, and so please tick that bottom box. I would like to investigate further so we can answer the questions you've got, which will be different to other people's. That's why we need to do it privately with you. And we'd love to do that with you. So please be ticking that one. If you don't in our faculty group, then please, by all means, tick that one and find out more about the faculty group. But friends, what about you? Who runs your life? Are you the king or is Christ? Who do you think Jesus was? Who do you think he was? For if he is the Christ who came to die for the sins of the world, then you need to give your life to him. For one day he will call you for it. If he's not the Christ, if he didn't come to die for the sins of the world, then he is somebody that you need to oppose, because he demands people to give their whole life to him. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for your son. We thank you for the privilege we have of being able to study it this day. We do pray that you would help us, each one, to know the truth, to be people who would inquire and find out, and be people of integrity, that knowing the truth, we would live the truth. so that seeing Jesus as the King, we would deny ourselves, take up the cross and follow him. And we'd ask it in Jesus' name.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.